This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And Young. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Shauna Ray. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis in Albany. The time is 6:05. Our evening news ran a little long tonight. Coming up next is Occupy Radio.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
It's about time.
Welcome to Occupy Portland Radio. I'm Jimmy Tardy.
I'm Joe Lino.
We're joined in the studio today by S. Brian Wilson. Some of you may know him as the author of the book Blood on the Tracks, which is an account of his longtime activism efforts and direct confrontation of U.S. international policy in a number of arenas, specifically the military. Use of force around the world in a number of different contexts, beginning in Vietnam and continuing to this day. Thanks for joining us, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to talk today about Brian's hunger strike that he's been doing in solidarity with the prisoners in Guantanamo, Cuba, who've been hunger striking for, 100 days, some of them now?
Some of them more than 100 days.
And it's 80-plus people, more than 100 days. They're enduring, to start with, they've been enduring being snatched up from their villages in the middle of the night by a heavily armed group of, I'm sure, very nice men, transported in hoods in the back of a C-140 halfway across the world, held in secret detention, who knows what sort of treatment they got there. And then they end up in Guantanamo, and this is all, of course, under the auspices of the War on Terror. And a number of the hunger strikers ended up in Guantanamo, Cuba, and have actually been cleared for release from Guantanamo, as they've been determined to not be a threat. And then trying to be brief here, but there's all the other twists and turns that have led to the situation that we're in now, where they're still there, and they've decided that the only recourse that they have, I read a quote one of them said the other day, is they won't let us live in peace, and they want to die in peace. And there goes on further to say that the authorities there at Guantanamo won't even let them die in peace because of these force feedings that they're enduring, which is just the smallest part of this whole saga. Brian has been 17 days now fasting and appearing at City Hall during the week, and you guys have been also rallying. Is it Holiday Park on the weekend?
Well, we were at Holiday Park for the Monsanto rally last Saturday.
Okay.
Or last weekend.
Flying a banner to bring attention to this issue. And so we're going to talk about that today. And the phone lines will be open, and we'll be asking for you to call, share with us what you think about this issue, what you think about the history of it, what you think about what we're doing about it right now. And I'm going to be playing the, as best I can, role of devil's advocate in this conversation to try to, well, at least give Brian a moving target. So, Brian, I guess first off, how do you feel?
I feel fine right now so far.
You're
17 days, but I'm eating 300 calories a day of very carefully selected vegetables, a few fruits, 4 ounces, 2 ounces of protein, and 4 ounces of oats and 4 ounces of millet. And I have all the calories identified by each food so that I know when I'm getting close to 300.
Uh-huh.
And when I might go over 300. Some days I only take 280. I've been at 310, but basically 300 calories a day.
Right, right. And I understand that part of the reason that you didn't go on a water-only fast was to keep your partner happy about you doing this.
I've done water-only fasts in the past, a number of them actually, but I was younger.
Right.
My body was a little stronger, more durable, and now I'm 1 month shy of 72, and so I felt I could go on an indefinite fast on 300 calories a day in solidarity with the hunger strikers and also Diane Wilson, who's another faster in Washington, D.C., who is on water only.
And she's about a month now?
Yeah, she's about a month, but she actually her sister just died in Texas, so she just went back to bury her sister. And I think temporarily she's on juice alternating with water until, and then her mother's dying. So so she's in Texas right now, but she's been at the White House for at least 25 days before she went to Texas, water only.
And that's Diane?
Diane Wilson, with one L.
With one L. Well, our thoughts are with you, Diane. So, physically, you feel
so far,
fine?
So far, I feel fine.
Continuing to bicycle from your home to downtown? And
hand cycle, yes.
Hand cycle.
Three-wheel hand cycle.
Yeah.
I need to stay active as long as possible.
Yeah, for sure.
It's only 6 or 7 miles from my house to the city hall and back. So that's a 12-14 mile round trip.
Right.
Can you at least briefly tell us the process that went on in this decision to?
Yeah, I was reading. An account of how the actual force feeding works, and how they were strapping these guys in their head, chest, midsection, feet, and arms, and then pushing this tube, an oversized tube, into their nose that makes their nose bleed and pushes it down into their stomach, which makes them throw up, even though they're trying to get what they're giving them, Ensure, E-N-S-U-R-E, this supplement. And I was seeing myself in that position. How could I handle that? And by the way, force feeding itself is in violation of international law. And so I went out in my garden at 3 a.m. I couldn't quite sleep, and I just started crying thinking about it. Like, it was so evil, so medieval, so sadistic. So, in fact, these men have been there 11 years with no charges, no trials. Now they're keeping him alive through another element of torture. Force feeding is considered an aspect of torture. So I started crying, and I thought, what am I going to do? I can't just know that it's happening. I have to express myself in some fashion. So I decided the next morning that I would go on a fast in solidarity with their fast, their hunger strike, but I would do it on 300 calories so that I wasn't in any immediate danger over the next couple, 3 months. I could actually probably go 5 months without any real serious problems, and I don't even know what I would feel after 5 months. But that was the origins of my decision.
Okay.
So, this visceral reaction that you talk about having, tell me more about that, and maybe we'll talk a little bit about these emotional responses to this kind of thing. And
I didn't know much about this until I was in Vietnam. I had some very strong visceral reactions to seeing the villagers being murdered and napalmed, and they were, you know, they were so-called enemy, but they really were children. And I threw up, and I was crying, and I was a commander even. I was a commander of 40 troops. And that just so affected me. I mean, it affected my ideology and my thought process. Like, wow, this is really sickening and disgusting. But I was feeling it. And ever since that experience, I have often been in touch with what I call the body wisdom, my body wisdom, the feelings I have inside as to whether something seems like the correct path for me, or maybe veer off that a little bit to try something else. I had the same reaction when I started practicing law, and when the bailiff said, "Everybody rise," and with the flag on the wall behind the judge, and I felt my whole body going into a revulsion, even though this was normal protocol, it wasn't anything unusual. My whole body was shaking. My head said, "You don't have to like it. You just have to stand up because this is the protocol for your profession." And I did. It happened 3 times, but it was very visceral. It wasn't that intellectual. My head was saying, "Please do it. Your career is on the line." And my body, I was shaking in my chest and in my stomach, and it was had something to do with the symbolism of automatically obeying authority figure, which I had done in the military for 4 years. And I thought, you know, I have to honor this strong feeling I have because it's telling me something. And it was from that I started reading psychologists' versions of various transformations and epiphanies in history. I read James Hillman, I read Carl Jung, among others, learning about body wisdom. Wow, it wasn't just in my imagination. And the viscera has tremendous power to motivate actions, much more so than ideas in the head. And so I've come to realize that, in fact, I've discovered in my readings over the years that since the Enlightenment, which we all thought was a great idea, was all head-oriented, rational, reasonableness, but it forgot about the body and our connection to the earth. It was reductionist rather than holistic. So to me, knowing how to identify your feelings and finding avenues for sharing them and expressing them, especially things like anger and rage, which are feelings. You feel them in the body. You might talk about them in your head through using your brain, but they're feelings in the body. You tense up. Anger at something.
I think anger is actually considered a precognitive response of the body. It doesn't even involve thought before that
right.
starts to happen.
And anger is usually a cover for feeling hurt, a more primary feeling of actually feeling hurt. I feel hurt or invalidated. I'm somehow not considered worthy because I have this feeling, or the feeling comes as a result of something that happened that make me feel unworthy. So to me, I think it's really an important, it's an incredibly indispensable source of information for being a human being, being a responsible human being. So I don't take lightly strong feelings in my body. Like when I went out in the garden and started crying, thinking about, my God, I was thinking, what would I be doing if they were strapping me down and force feeding them? I hadn't been tried for 11 years. I haven't seen my family in 11 years. I've been hooded all the way from my village in Pakistan or Iraq or Afghanistan until I got to Guantanamo. 11 years. I mean, that is not even comprehensible. So it was just, I mean, this is a very mild response, fasting for 300 calories a day in solidarity. It really is a relatively quite mild response. And it is indefinite for me. So I don't have a definitive end date. Diane Wilson has initially announced that she would fast until the prisoners were released, which is not likely to happen in the time frame in which she would live on a water-only fast. You might live 70 days if you were lucky, usually 60 days or 55 days. So mine is indefinite, but again, I think of prisoners who were snatched in the Great War on Terror, which is a war of terror on poor people who are desperate to be freed of what I call our wholesale terror. The Great War on Terror is just a fraud on our minds and our souls and everybody else that's in the way. How would I feel if somebody had came and snatched me from my home in my garden in Portland, hooded me, put me on took me in a vehicle to a plane, hooded. I didn't know where I was going, and I was in the process. They would be torturing me in the process all the way along the line, and it goes on for 11 years, and I haven't been able to tell my wife what happened to me. I'm not able to tell anybody what happens to me because I'm not allowed to communicate with anybody. I'm just to listen to the interrogators saying, what do you know about this and what do you know about that, and know that this is going to go on indefinitely. I couldn't know how to live, at least right now, on my daily life without doing something in response to that condition and to that situation. And we should understand that this whole thing was started, the creation of the Mujahideen was funded by the CIA in Afghanistan starting in 1980. Carter announces in July of 79 that he's going to fund Contras to overthrow the newly progressive created government in Afghanistan that was now allowing women education, no more covering of their heads, but they were allied with the Soviet Union. And so 6 months later, the Soviet Union came in to bail out their friend, who by that time was being overthrown by Carter's Contras. And then that started our 11-year campaign to fund the Mujahideen to oust the Soviets. And out of that came the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. You have to get some context to understand how all these feelings how they develop, these feelings of rage against the West. And so now we have a war on terror where the president can send on Tuesdays to decide who's going to get killed. And how the hell would we know who's what 9,000 miles away? We have such terrible capacity to identify friend from foe, even if we were in our right minds, which we're not. It's just incredibly barbaric. Barbaric. And it's in my name as a U.S. citizen. It's being conducted in my name. The president was born in the United States. His assistants were born here, or most of them were, but they certainly have been raised here. The military personnel at Guantanamo came out of families that were born here. I was born here. They're doing this in my name. And I have to, in some way, make it really clear. It's not with my consent.
So let's talk for a minute about, so you're saying, you mentioned earlier how when you were in that courtroom and you were having that response of not wanting to obey this authority and stand.
It had nothing to do with the judge. It was right, symbolic.
Right. Let's talk for a minute about what it's like to be, in your opinion, what you remember about being that obedient soldier and what life was like through those eyes.
Well, you have to understand that when I went in the military, I was 25. I already had a master's degree, and I was halfway through law school. I was drafted. I had to do 4 years because I joined the Air Force rather than be inducted into the Army or the Marines. And I became an officer. And so life was actually going along just fine for me. I loved being born and raised in the United States. I'd been active in my church. I'd been a good student, a good athlete. I simply would have rather stayed in graduate school than go in the military. That's my background. It sets me up emotionally and psychologically. I was pretty content. I'm a white male. I mean, I had everything going for me. I was going to make a lot of money as a lawyer. So I'm in the military. My first 2 years, I'm at Headquarters Air Force as a young lieutenant, writing security regs to protect air bases from various security threats. It's very white collar, very, very plush job.
Very normal.
Yeah.
What years were these? How far along?
I was in Headquarters Air Force late 66, 67, most of 68.
Okay.
So you were doing a job.
I was doing my job, and it was an easy job. They identified me that I could write, so I was writing regs. I'd been in graduate school. Figured, okay, you can read things and write things down. And I mean, I was pretty dumbed down, as I realized later. But at the time, you know, I was typically educated. Then I got my orders to go to be an Air Force Ranger. I didn't even know they had such a thing, and I certainly didn't volunteer for it. And they sent me to Fort Campbell, Kentucky, to be trained 12 weeks with 550 other airmen, 20 officers and 530 enlisted men. So I was just a little bit of a curveball I had to deal with to get through this 4 years to get back to my career. And there was actually another moment in bayonet training where I had this strong visceral reaction in the bayonet training. I had gone through all the marksmanship training. I had learned how to fire an M16 at targets, at human
silhouettes.
I learned how to fire two different kinds of machine guns. I learned how to fire a 45 and a 38, all at silhouettes. I had to learn mortars. I had to learn rocket propelled grenades. I had to learn all that, and I wasn't excited about it, but you know, I got my marksmanship badge, and it was just kind of routine.
Part of the job.
Yeah. But then there was bayonet training, where you're about 5 feet in front of a stuffed dummy, and you're being ordered to affix the bayonet and scream as loud as you could 100 times as you're plunging that bayonet into the dummy 100 times. You're trying to eliminate any integrity left to that dummy. You want it to be in just feathers, practically. And so I fixed the bayonet. and everybody else was already doing this. They were training us officers separately in that exercise. So there were 20 officers, which I was one of them. And we were trained by sergeants who had been going through the Army Rangers training. So, but for purpose of the training, they were our trainers.
They were in charge.
They were in charge. And so the sergeant saw that I was hesitating, and he screamed at me a couple times. And I actually, another case where my head was just saying, you don't have to like it, just do it. Just do it. You just get it over with. It'll be nothing. After you get it done, you'll never have to deal with this again. And by this time, I'm 27 or 28, I forget, 27. And so I was really feeling that this is repulsive. My head is saying, that's okay. Just allow it. You can be okay. You can feel repulsive, but just do it. And I hesitated long enough that the sergeant came over again and screamed in my ear, and he bumped me, I think, inadvertently, and I lost my balance. I was nervous, and I went down on my knee, and I wasn't hurt. But I then looked up at him. I said, I'm not doing this training. But it was the feelings in my body, and, of course, I was... Had to go meet the commander. Spent 2 hours in his office being grilled. Back at his office at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, and I remember him saying to me, "You're as good as the VC, and the VC are vermin." And I said, "Well, if you think I'm as good as the VC, why would you even want me in your unit?" And he says, too late to make any changes, any personnel changes.
So up to this point, you've been exemplary.
I mean, I don't know if they consider me exemplary. I was doing what everybody else was doing successfully. You know, although I did flunk the MAP course, I was out lost in the woods for 3 days and nights with another captain. And we were trying to learn map reading with our compass, and we got hopelessly lost. So I can't say that I was exemplary, but you know. Anyway, so I don't know what the question was that triggered that long response, but that was another case where my body was saying, my arms were saying to me. 15 years later, I'm studying Jung, and I concluded that my arms had the archetypal wisdom that we are all wired as social beings to be cooperative and mutually respectful. And if you have toxicity directed towards somebody else, that toxicity will return sooner or later in one way or another. That would not be anything I had in my head. That would have been an ancient wisdom that I was accessing in my body.
That's the archetypal term that you use,
right?
There, which goes,
it's primordial or innate. It's an innate or primordial or original feeling that came with mammals and early Homo sapiens, and actually couldn't have gotten this far in our branch of evolution without cooperation, the most indispensable behavioral characteristic of all to survive. We're wired to be social, and to be social, you cooperate and learn how to function together to accomplish your food, to get your food, to have your community. I really got into the archetypes, and I thought, well, when I saw the woman in Vietnam, which I didn't even talk about here on the ground in front of me after a bombing, I looked at her eyes, and the napalm had burned her eyelids off. I was in shock. I was in a village within minutes after the bombing. Everybody was dead, I think. A few moaning, were just about to die.
And you were there because you were there to count the bodies.
I was there to count the bodies. That was my job. My job was to assess the success of a bombing mission.
Body count,
and the
was
success
one way.
Was defined by bodies.
All right.
And I looked in her eyes, and I started crying. and I was throwing up bile juice. I had a handkerchief over my nose and mouth because the odor was so pungent, the burning flesh, the lingering droplets of napalm, the chemical residues of the bombs. And I was with a lieutenant, a Vietnamese lieutenant who spoke fluent English, and he asked me what my problem was. I was in shock, I'm sure, because I had also seen this water buffalo with dying with on its side with a big gash in its belly, roaring, these loud moans of pain, half of his head gone. And I said something to that lieutenant that definitely came out of a deep place. I said, I'm looking at my sister, and these are my family members.
This wasn't the first time that you had been there to assess the success of them. It was.
It was. I did had to do four more after that, but I wasn't the same after that. So, and then I realized, well, this is intentional. This is all, this is part of the war. It's intentional. They need body counts. This was under Nixon's early months of Vietnamization where they had to build up more body counts by the Vietnamese. I mean, by the Vietnamese soldiers under our guidance. I was so appalled that I flew that week after I'd been in five villages. This is getting off target, but I went to Saigon to meet with our intelligence office, and I wanted to know, I wanted to look at the bombing reports for the previous week in Phong Dinh and Vinh Long provinces where I had been. And my intelligence officer had those reports. And I said, well, this looks like the places, some of the places I was at. And all these reports show X number of VC dead here, X number of VC standing for Viet Cong, which was itself a derogatory term for the National Liberation Front. And the officer said to me, who he'd gone through the same training in Fort Campbell and I had, he said, you know, that we've been mystified by the fact that we get these reports that entire VC units are destroyed in bombings. But then that same unit we discover appears several days later in another location. I said, well, here's the explanation. They're bombing inhabited villages who are sitting ducks. They don't have weapons. And the planes are coming in at 300 feet. Because they know there's no anti-aircraft, or not even any any rifles, and so everybody's destroyed. And they take photographs and they estimate how many are dead. And I said, "Well, in the village, so I went. I counted somewhere between 700 and 900 dead in those five villages." And I said, "Way more than half were children. You can tell by the size of the corpse, the burned corpses." And so that was an amazing revelation. Well, that was a confirmation to me because I was still hoping there was an explanation for this. I didn't really want to believe that this was intentional. And he then said, wow, we hadn't thought of that. And he, before he died a few years ago, this guy looked me up on email and he wanted to thank me for unraveling that mystery for him. He wanted me to know that before he died. That was just 5 years ago. So this is off, a little bit off, but
so you found yourself in Vietnam doing a job,
yeah,
and then suddenly things changed, and you found yourself accessing parts of yourself that
I did not know existed.
So let's fast forward to the situation that we're in today, and the fast that you're holding now. Regarding the prisoners in Guantanamo specifically, even broader, the U.S. military, we were talking about earlier, the authorization for use of military force, what that means, and how it has provided people with jobs to go and do. And so, for instance, just as a jumping off point, and we'll see where it goes, the guy who, or woman, who inserts the feeding tube into the nostril of this person who has been declared innocent.
I don't think they've been declared innocent. They just haven't been charged.
Well, there's a significant number of them that are cleared for release.
Well, 600 have already left Guantanamo. And it's 86 have been cleared. It's true. 86 yeah. of the 100. There's 166 prisoners there now. 86 have been cleared for release. And nobody can give us a good explanation, really, of why they haven't been released.
So, let's go into that real quick. So a lot of these people are Yemeni citizens.
86 of them are.
And that would imply that they're intended to be returned to Yemen. Of course, and maybe we'll start to get into the speech that Obama made, was it last Thursday now? He talked about drones. We were talking earlier about how he stated that all of this is legal due to the authorization of military force. And
which was passed in September or October 2001 to be specifically related to finding who was behind 9/11.
Right. And worded in such a way that it just opened the door to pretty much use of military force in any context.
Anywhere, anytime in the world.
The president refers to that authorization for the use of military force. And in his speech, he talks about how that makes such things as drone attacks, which he's become kind of famous for being such a proponent of, makes those legal. Legal under a very narrow definition of the term legal, I guess legal in the eyes of 535 American citizens who decided that, oh yeah, this is legal and we'll go ahead and vote for that.
Actually, there were some that voted against that authorization.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
But including 23 senators, but not John Kerry. John Kerry voted for it. I was used to work with Kerry.
Yeah, so, I've seen the pictures.
So I try to get a hold of him before the vote, and I say, please, you're not going to vote for this.
He didn't want to take your call.
No, he didn't, and he didn't.
Well, so there is a legal framework in place that has been enacted by Congress, and whether it's actually truly could stand any sort of historical assessment of its legality is another question. Any sort of assessment of its rationality is a whole another question. But it does at least let us know that as far as the United States is concerned, we're going to go ahead and do this, because this is, you know, this is Bush with
waterboarding.
The waterboarding thing and that whole thing, how they said, oh, well, you know, we thought that was legal, so give us a pass on this. So this allows pretty much the United States military to do, we thought this was legal.
Of course,
so
it's in violation of international law. Absolutely. And when you violate international law, from most of the laws that we consider part of the international law, including Nuremberg, the U.S. is a signatory to.
Right.
And international law under Article 6 of the U.S. Constitution makes every treaty we sign part of the Constitution.
Right.
So it's in violation of our Constitution. It really doesn't matter, because we are a lawless society, and we always have been a lawless society. Another reason I got out of the law, realizing that I can't work in that kind of pretend. But yes, the rhetoric is by those who have the power that whatever they're doing is legal. If it serves their power needs, it will be called legal. And how anybody can consider identifying people 9,000 miles away in other countries as they call them insurgents or militants. They're civilians. They're citizens. They're people who live in villages. In Vietnam, everybody we killed was a civilian. And some of them get mad when we bomb them or invade them, and they take up arms against us. And we call them combatants, but they're really civilians who have a right under international law to defend themselves, right, from foreign invading countries. So how one can rationalize this mass murder and live with oneself? You don't see the person. You don't have to put them on trial. You don't hear them. It's like you can do this at any time, any place you want, anywhere in the world, and there's no absolutely no accountability whatsoever. And do I believe that the president knows who's being killed? Yes, he's given cards that the CIA has given him of names, and they have all this money to make cards on all these so-called enemies. And he'll pick some out to be killed that day. And, you know, he feels, I mean, he obviously doesn't bother him. And the fact that it doesn't bother the country enough to just go out in the streets on strike and say, this has so affected our moral and spiritual essence as a nation that we can't function anymore. And so we're just going to go on strike or go on fast or just, I mean, to me, that would be the appropriate response. He said, well, force me to close Guantanamo, for example. Well, you know, we also live in a police state. You might as well call it a fascist state. It basically has gotten much worse since 9/11. And when you read the accounts of how the Department of Homeland Security and the Portland Police and the FBI were dealing with the Portland Occupy, we were just reading it again last night, it's incredible how terrified the system is of anything that might reek of truth or accountability of their status quo policies. And so Obama can say all these nice things. I mean, he pleases everybody, and he doesn't please me. But I know he's able to please lots of people who have different opinions about different subjects, and they each think he has said something. He is saying something that agrees with them, and they are completely opposite about the subject. So he's a master at it. He's an incredible master at it. He probably would be Edward Bernays' prize pupil of the founder of modern publicity and propaganda, because he's a brand for corporate America.
So, you were saying earlier, which was something we'd been talking about before we went on the air, about Obama has basically taken the stance of, you know, the American people have to hold me accountable. If the American people want something to happen, they have to make it known. So just briefly, really quickly, let me just say real fast here. The phone lines are open. The number is 503-231-8187. S. Brian Wilson's here in the studio with us. We'd love to hear what you think about this issue. And while we're waiting for some phones to start ringing, let me go ahead and play devil's advocate here for Obama, because I want to make sure, not necessarily to cheerlead for Obama, but to at least make sure that there's some things that aren't forgotten, which are actually very recent. So in 2009, Obama signed that presidential directive, which said that Guantanamo would be closed basically 1 year after he became president. Mm-hmm. And then there was such an outpouring of bile and misinformation and partisan rage over that issue. They stoked so much fear over that issue, just really made people just lose their minds. And then they went ahead and Congress passed some laws. I've got them right here. I can get
well,
to
they
them.
Forbade any of those prisoners from coming to the United States, for sure.
For coming to the United States. And they also put restrictions on if they were going to transfer them to another country. And I was just reading it right here. The Secretary of Defense has to certify to Congress that a number of different things, but that
say, for instance, any country that a detainee goes to has to maintain effective control over that transferred detainee, taking effective steps to ensure that the transferred person does not pose a future threat to the United States, agreed to take such steps as the secretary deems necessary to prevent the detainee from engaging in terrorism. You know, basically, all that leads to is if somebody is transferred out of Guantanamo, they end up in Yemen, and, you know, to really take a firm stance, again, as a devil's advocate here, which of those two situations would be better? And politically, if one of these people was released, and I mean, this seems likely to happen to me, that anybody that's had this type of treatment ends up released, comes back home, his family's disintegrated, one of his kids has died, he's already gone through all this trauma.
Right.
This person, I mean, where are they going to be, and what are they going to do in return? What are they going to feel like they have any sort of power? They're going to strike back at the United States, and where's that going to leave us?
Well, if we continue treating people the way we treat them, you know, it's a never-ending cycle of vengeance. But Obama could direct his Secretary of War or Secretary of Defense, Hagel, he could direct him. He said, I want a directive that starts releasing all these prisoners. You're going to certify that the main certification is that it's in the interest of U.S. national security to do that. And it's not in the interest of the U.S. national security to keep creating terrorists. It's just we're creating an endless supply of rage directed at us. That is not in my interest. And when will the U.S. decide? It, by the way, the U.S. has 45 military bases in the Middle East, of which 14 have been added since 2001. When are we going to decide to pull our military out of the Middle East, stop supporting Israel's occupation and apartheid of the Palestinians, and actually then begin treating all these Muslim countries as countries that we would want to have diplomatic relations and actually start talking about a civilized behavior? Because we're not civilized. That's the thing. Our behavior is not civilized. And it creates what I would call our wholesale terrorism creates retail terrorism. And it's an endless cycle until we stop our wholesale terrorism. And we've eliminated the Magna Carta, basically. We eliminated habeas corpus under Obama. The National Defense Authorization Act basically authorizes indefinite detention for U.S. citizens without any end date or trial.
So, again, playing the devil's advocate, just real quickly, I'm going to say that he did make a signing statement when he signed the NDAA into law that he wouldn't use it against American citizens. I hope that still stands.
It's the law.
It is the law. The man has some power, but he is also, that's political power that he has. So it depends on political maneuvering. So some of this has to at least be acknowledged that he is playing a political game here.
Of course, he's president.
And he wants to get reelected. I mean, this is all...
He doesn't have to worry about that now. He can't be reelected.
Right. So we're going to push him. That's where I hope we're going with this, is that we, the people, are... It's time for us to start pushing our president
where we want him to go. But the question is, how do you do the pushing?
Well...
It's not through the ballot box. It's not through writing letters. And unless there's sufficient numbers of people to be in the streets... actually can say, look, we're going to obstruct business as usual and face the police. The police are going to be facing us.
Yeah.
Unless we're willing to do that or go on lots of fasts. I agree. But I would say that this has been the case since World War II. We have invaded 390 times since World War II.
Yeah.
We are an empire of plunder. The president's job is to make sure that empire is continued. And
sure.
If he decided to exercise his human moral faculties, even if it meant being threatened that he would be killed, it would be a huge breakthrough.
Absolutely.
Culturally and historically for the United States.
So we're going to go to a caller here real quick, and we're going to go to John in just a moment. And let me just say, you know, whatever it takes, if we have to get out in the streets with the cops pepper spraying us and beating us and arresting us, you know what? Been there, done that, and that's what it takes. And it's not something you should complain about, because the alternative is horrific. So we're going to go to John now real quick. John, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I really don't have a contribution to the discussion. I just have admired Brian Wilson for 20-some years and admire KABU for exposing exactly the kinds of things that you are in this broadcast. I wish I knew. I probably knew more about 30 years ago if you'd asked me. I'd say, well, yeah, we got to do this and this and this. And now I'm doing a lot more listening.
So do you feel that over time you've become less engaged? Is that what you're saying? I'm not really sure what.
Well, no, I just thought that I knew what, you know, what ought to be done, and now I really don't.
Oh, I got you. The situation is incredibly complex. I think we can all agree on that.
I don't agree that murder is complex. Murder is a basic common law crime. Anybody that commits murder is subject to imprisonment for life or capital punishment.
Sure enough,
that's, and I do not consider I do not consider that issue complex. I do not consider the drone issue complex myself.
Okay, fair enough. The complexity does come in the way that our country works, and to get people to do what we're talking about here is obviously tricky. There was 6,000 people in the streets October 6th of 2011, and that number plummeted quickly because people thought, oh, I don't even know what they thought. I don't know. I'm still here. I stuck it out. I watched those numbers plummet. I don't know where those folks went, but I thought we were on to something. I still think we're on to something.
You are on to something.
Well, I still think we are. The level of outrage is just keeps asserting itself.
It's percolating. It's percolating out of view, maybe, out of view of the media, and it doesn't have a camp, but it's percolating because the system is so corrupt. It's so immoral. It leaves no future for most people that have any kind of just modest intelligence about what's going on. It's terrible. And that we have to now regroup as humans. We have to rediscover what it means to have human community.
And feelings.
Well, that's an integral part of being human.
I think we're numb. Well, that's numbed by a lot of things.
That's true.
Numb and distracted.
But we're distracted by television and texting and electronic devices. I think basically, we need a lot of face-to-face, eyeball-to-eyeball interaction with one another, which is what was happening in those camps, in those Occupy camps. There's nothing to me that substitutes for that kind of personal eyeball-to-eyeball, looking at body language, really getting down to the fact that we are our brothers and sisters, and we need each other, and not with electrons separating us. We need each other in the same room, in the same park, in the same commons, and we need it happening in lots of places or all over the place, which was why Occupy was so terrifying to the system. People were gathering. There were 2,500 Occupy camps in the United States. There were another 1,000 or so around the world. This was scaring the system. People were real human beings were getting together to say this system doesn't work, and it's corrupt and immoral and criminal. And the only correction to that is human beings coming together and saying we're not going to put up with it anymore.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm fasting. If I knew how to organize a million people to be in the streets, I might do it. But we'd have to stay in the streets. It's not like one day. You have to stay in the streets. You have to have cadres of people to keep us fed and So, I mean, Tunisia fell because a million people, or maybe 300,000 people, were in the streets and they didn't leave. And then it went to Egypt.
Right.
And that's what it takes here, too.
Yeah.
And people aren't used to that. Sustained, determined use of that anger to say, you will not do this to me anymore. My dignity is more important than my longevity, and you're done as far as my loyalty is concerned. I mean, after Vietnam, you know, I was in another world. I was no longer the loyal boy. I was a really good boy when I was growing up. I did everything right, and everybody loved me. And guess what? It was all wrong. Wow, that was really shocking to me to discover that. And I was good. I mean, honor student, valedictorian, all-conference athlete, president of my Baptist Youth Fellowship, you know, going off to law school. It was all a lie. It was all built on a lie.
Right. We're gonna end it right there. I'm Jimmy Tardy. I've been here with Joe Leno and Brian Wilson.
Brian, thank you so much for coming in tonight.
This is Occupy Portland Radio, and once again, remember,
Occupy!
I want to show you guys these.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 7:01. Up next, Hard Knock Radio, right after these messages.
The Village Building Convergence is back. Using art, natural building products, and permaculture practices, City Repair is working with volunteers by day to help transform the city at 38 different locations throughout the Portland metro area, from May 24th through June 1st. Then, at night, everyone involved converges at the Alberta Abbey in Northeast Portland to celebrate community with music, dinner, and dancing. KBOO Community Radio will be providing music in the evenings. There are also workshops and keynote speakers related to community building and placemaking at this week-long event. More information and tickets can be found on the right-hand side of the events page at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio and Community Supported Everything are proud to co-sponsor All Together Now, a four-hour festival of radical positivity.
Grab a radio, May 31st, 8 p.m. to midnight, and tune in to 90.7 FM KBOO as we gather on the Southeast waterfront for this decentralized community festival.
KBOO will be broadcasting a four-hour special set of dance music with updates from the Village Building Convergence as people share their ideas about how to make Portland a more beautiful, resilient, and better place to live. Wherever you are on May 31st, tune in to KBOO 90.7 FM.
All Together Now, a four-hour festival of radical positivity, Friday, May 31st, 8 p.m. to midnight.
More information about community-supported everything can be found online at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the events page.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone.
The Breakfast with the Boo 45th birthday event is shaping up to be a well-attended morning, where we plan to feed pancakes and fruits, nuts, and flakes to more than 1,000 people. KBOO needs to borrow pancake griddles, waffle irons, large coffee makers, and coffee and tea carafes to ensure quick service for the hungry masses. We also need help with food donations and people to flip pancakes, seat guests, bus tables, and decorate the auditorium. If you can help with any of this, please contact Lynn Fitch, manager at kboo.org, or leave a message 503-231-8032, extension 222.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
What's up, fam? You're tuned to Hard Knock Radio. On today's program, we look at restorative justice with Miss Davis. And later on in the program, Waylon Southern, one of the co-founders of Hard Knock Radio, brings us a conversation with the one and the only Dave Zirin, talking about his new book, Game Over. I'm Anita Johnson. All this and more ahead.
Yo, this is M1 from Dead Press.
Hey, what's up? This is Boots from the Coup.
Nah, I mean, telling you to stay tuned to Hard Knock Radio.
Keep it locked.
On the move, this is Pam Africa on Hard Knock Radio, the station of resistance. Down with this rotten-ass system.
Yo, check this out. Hard Knock Radio coming at you, bringing the noise. This is Chuck D, Public Enemy number one. News, views, and hip-hop.
Peace and love. This is Azeem. You're listening to Hard Knock Radio, real radio, from the concrete up all the way to the sun. Keep shining, y'all.